And then someone went,
testing, 1, 2.
I can really taste the bacteria.
What's up, John? What's up, John Burton?
1, 2, 3, 4. Why you can't have a best?
Okay, wait. Let me rewind. John, you're right.
Right. I'm just going to play us in a little bit.
When are you going to tell me we're starting?
We started.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah, really well, because he's one of 7 kids and his oldest brother passed away a couple of weeks ago. So. At least we were there with the family. Yeah.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Just tell me what you've been up to.
Okay, so I'm working on a book.
Oh, good. Okay.
About the VA. And they're probably not going to be all that happy with me.
You're not afraid of that?
No, not even a little. And the fact is, if for me, it's not about what they're doing wrong so much as how we can get them to do better. And in this current administration, Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting conversation.
Well, yeah, let's start there then. Okay. Are we screwed for 3.5 years?
I'm really concerned. I am really concerned. And I am particularly concerned. I mean, everybody's got their line of sight, right? And mine is especially focused on veterans. Veterans are screwed. And until more courts start saying more no's to the current administration, bad things are going to continue to happen. They've already dismissed a couple of thousand of employees at the VA, and they're planning on getting rid of 80,000.
80,000 VA employees?
VA employees, yes. 80,000 more VA employees, yes.
Do you read into that Musk left and the courts yesterday said your tariffs are kind of out of bounds? Do you read into that, you know, and the budget, you know, the budget was bigger than everybody thought. Do you read any, is there any hope in that?
There is some hope in that.
Okay.
It's so early in the hope spark that it's hard for me to get the fire burning for that hope. But I'm, you know me, I tend to be more optimistic than pessimistic. Mm-hmm. And as long as I'm breathing, I'm going to be pushing back when stuff is stupid. So we'll see how this plays out, this last 24 hours plays out in moving forward. There's no way to predict with this administration what their next stupid move is going to be. And I'm just going to go with this bodes positively for the plans that they currently have, which is to get rid of, like I said, another 80,000 employees.
And how many, tell me again, how many did they let go so far?
About 2,500.
Jeez. What's the... can you steel man the argument for that? Can you make the other side's argument for that?
Hell no.
There's no other argument for it.
There is no argument for this. You know, they can say they're trying to save money. They can say they're trying to streamline. But when my child signed up for the military, I went and spoke to the recruiter myself because I didn't believe the things he was telling my 18-year-old kid. And they made promises that should have been kept but weren't. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we lost Daniel.
Right.
That is entirely unacceptable on so many levels. But what they're trying to do now is lessen the workforce. And the reason that we lost Daniel was because they didn't have enough of a workforce. Mm. So you take another 80,000 employees out of
How many employees are there in the VA?
Several hundred thousand.
Okay, all right.
So it's about a third.
Okay.
It's about a third.
Is there any, again, this is not my side of the fence, but is there any argument to be made that two-thirds of the right people can do more than all the collective if they're not the right people?
There is some argument to be made on that. There is no question. The VA is not unlike any other large corporate entity. You're going to know when you work there which guy is pretending to work and which guy is working right. twice as hard.
Right.
It's the same way at the VA. There is a higher than average number of people working at the VA who are on the working twice as hard as they need to be working to do their jobs. Because a good 70 to 80% of those employees are veterans.
Mm. So, right.
You know, they're trying to help the people that they served with and
right.
the people they served for and their families. And you're now, when you talk about getting rid of 80,000 people, you're talking about getting rid, two-thirds of those at least will be veterans who are employed in the federal government at the VA because of their experience, and their experience is invaluable to the care that the veterans who come in there for treatment get.
Yeah.
So you're talking about everybody from the guy who cleans the operating room, because, you know, that's the first person that's going to go because they're trying to get rid of people who won't fight so much, right? So the guy who cleans the operating room now has an operating room that's not clean and a surgeon who needs to do a job. So who's going to do that? Is the surgeon expected to be the person that takes care of the operating room so that they can actually do the job that they trained their entire adult lives to do? Makes no sense. It makes no sense. And there were things about the VA that didn't make sense before. But this just makes that look like rocket science.
It kind of feels like they set out to just say, okay, we have an end number in mind, globally, for the government. Right. And so we're just going to skim a third off of everything.
Right.
And to me, it would have taken years to figure out where everybody agrees there's fat.
Right, of course.
But it takes years to figure out where that fat is.
Right.
And the challenge is the only way to get to know what that fat is without those years is to talk to the fat.
Right.
And the fat will the fat will tell you.
Right.
Yeah, you know, we can make a big difference in somebody else's life by giving them an extra shift and get rid of this
right,
person.
Right.
And that might be true, but you have to serve the greater good.
Exactly. Exactly. And for the people who have served and have had promises made that can't be kept, this is such a kick in the gut.
Yeah.
You know, it's mind-numbing. And if Daniel were still alive, he would be the first one standing there outside of his local VA with big signs screaming through a megaphone, this is not okay.
Do you want to tell Daniel's story again? Because it's been a hot minute.
Just a bit. So Dan is my oldest son.
Right.
He served for 8 years in the 82nd Airborne as an intel analyst for the 7th Special Forces Group. He chose to do this during a time of great conflict across the globe, which made his parents a little uncomfortable.
Understandable.
Yeah, and he spent almost 26 months over two deployments in Kandahar, Afghanistan.
Ooh.
Yeah. By the time he was 21, he had done almost 26 months of servicing Kandahar, Afghanistan.
Did you communicate with him during that time much?
We actually spoke a lot more during that time than we did before that time.
Because
he had access to a phone that he could call home, and it was challenging. It was incredibly challenging.
Sure.
So a little connect with mom or dad or the siblings, that really helped him a lot.
Right.
And because of his location and the job that he did, I think he was given a lot of leeway on phone time that not everybody would necessarily have been given. He had a very high security clearance and was the lead intel analyst for the 7th Special Forces Group. So, he, yeah. At 19. Yeah. Go figure. I mean, Daniel was, to make this clear, Daniel was very, very smart. He got an 800 on the verbal and a 760 on the math SATs. He got a perfect score on the ASVAB, which is the test you take to figure out where you would be qualified to work in the military.
Right.
A perfect score. So he had a recruiter who was just oozing with glee. You know, he was practically drooling.
He's a big fish.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And he told Daniel, you can work anywhere you want, in whatever part of the Army you want to work in. It's not a problem. And I didn't believe him, so I went and I asked him some questions. They have this policy. If you train for a specific job in the military and you aren't able to be placed in that job, they will now let you leave without any questions asked. Of course, they're not going to give you the opportunity to train in an arena where you're not qualified and where you won't get the kind of position you want.
Right.
Especially if you're like Daniel. And I mean, he was human, just like all of us. He made some very stupid mistakes, but he really was what they were looking for.
Mm.
Right up to the picture of him looking just like Opie, red hair, freckles, the whole nine, right? So Dan served for 8 years in the 82nd, and when he came back from his second deployment, he was a little broken, and it took about 10 seconds of looking at him to realize that this was not going to be an easy fix.
Right.
But he did not want to tell anybody because he had this security clearance and he was very, very good at his job. He had done and seen some things in Kandahar that nobody should have to see.
Mm.
He had experienced, he was the lead intel for something called the Battle of Marja. Battle of Marja lost, to that point at least, more service members, more allied service members than any other incident in Afghanistan.
Wow.
And Daniel took it personally because he collected all the intel that brought them to that part of the country. They wouldn't have gone otherwise.
Right.
And he tried very, very hard for several weeks to get the command to understand that they needed to follow a certain set of guidelines. Otherwise, it was going to blow up in their faces. And, you know, he was a kid.
Yep.
And there was a commander
who
a lot of people in the world would recognize the name of and the picture of, who I'm leaving out of this.
Fair enough.
You know, but he said, look, Dan, and whenever a commander speaks to a soldier with their first name, there's a level of respect there that, that you can't imagine. So he said to Daniel, look, Dan, it's now in my hands. I make the decisions about how this plays out, and we're going to do it this way. So because what they were going to do was go in and let everybody know they were coming to make them run to the hills and hide, Daniel knew they weren't going to run to the hills and hide. They were going to be waiting. And so he went to every team leader that he could go to before they went out and said, look, these are the places where the problems are going to be. And this is what you should be looking for before you get to those spots. That will help you understand what you're coming into. And again, it was a catastrophic situation over several months. Daniel sat down after every single loss, every single casualty, and he wrote a letter to a survivor.
Mm.
And if he didn't know the soldier or the Marine himself, he went and found somebody who did.
Mm. And how old is he at this point?
About 20.
Jeez.
During Marja. Yeah. And he wrote a
letter. I don't know that I would have the wherewithal to do that now. And I'm older than 20.
You and me both. And I don't know how I got here. But yeah, he was a very compassionate and focused person, determined to help in any way he could. And this was important to him. He also built a library on the Kandahar airfield from the ground up. Mm. He filled it with books from an organization called Operation Paperback. And he went around the post and he got, you know, requests for genres and authors so that it was filled with books that soldiers he worked with would be able to put their heads into when they weren't in the middle of a conflict, right?
Wow.
So he did a lot of really good things, but he didn't take care of himself.
Okay.
And the good things that he did may have contributed to his level of despair, because you write 100+ letters.
Yeah.
You feel it in your bones. You feel it. And he was all of 20 years old when he was writing those letters, right? So he came home from Kandahar, and I knew, and he refused to get any help. So he continued on, and the Army has a program called the Green to Gold program. Green to Gold sends you to college as an active duty member of the military so that you can come out with a degree and become an officer. They really wanted him to be an officer. And he only had 3 years left to do, because he had done a year of college before he went into the Army. And
why did he go out and get out of college?
Okay, so Dan left college. He chose his college based on his sport. His sport was fencing. He had a grandfather. My dad was a very accomplished foil fencer.
Okay.
5-time Olympian, bronze medalist in Rome in 1960. Oh, wow. 12-time national champion. Yeah. He was accomplished.
Yeah.
And Daniel was so intrigued as a little boy that he took up fencing and became very, very good. He was the number 8 fencer in the country when he joined the Army.
Wow.
Yeah.
And fencing's no joke.
No.
Like, the shape you have to be in defense is is no joke.
Exactly.
I used to play squash.
Mm-hmm.
And so my teacher said, listen, you're going to take one fencing class. Because it's the same. It's like a lateral yeah. movement mm-hmm. and lunges and blah, blah. Mm-hmm. My ass was broken.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be in shape.
Fencing is really tough stuff. And my dad was 39 when he won his Olympic medal.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I grew up in that arena. The thing was...
How many squats can you do?
Don't even ask. Until I get new knees, I can't do any. I'm
fair
lucky
enough.
I
okay,
can
right.
sit down.
New knees are a legit excuse to not
there
do squats.
Go. There you go. But... my father engendered a certain sensibility from people. You either loved my dad or you loathed my dad.
Okay.
And both sides of that conversation are very legitimate.
Right.
He was very strong-willed, an incredibly successful aeronautical engineer who we hardly ever saw between his work, which was government work most of the time, and his fencing. We hardly ever saw him, but it was clear what kind of a person my dad was.
Right.
And in the fencing world, there were the people who did not particularly care for him. So Daniel chose St. John's University. Really bright kid. Didn't have to go to St. John's, but St. John's had the Olympic fencing coach.
Okay.
And he had been dancing circles around this guy for years. He'd gone to his summer programs. He'd tried to train with him, and he wouldn't take him because he wasn't at the school or on the Olympic team.
Mm.
So Daniel went to St. John's. And the day he got there, they made him the captain of the team because he was the highest ranked fencer on the team.
Okay.
And everything looked like peachy keen, except that he was bored to tears, you know, academically. And then they went to their first tournament at Princeton. Now, the Princeton coach knew Daniel very well. And so he said to the coach at St. John's, you know who his grandfather is, right? Because they had different last names.
Right.
There was no way to link it. The minute he found out that my dad was Daniel's grandfather, he started treating him like dirt.
Mm.
It was awful.
Okay.
And he called me one day and he said, I have to quit the team. I'm like, are you okay? He says, yeah, but I can't
right.
work
okay.
under the thumb of this person. And he was very worried that I would be upset. It wasn't inexpensive to get Daniel to the rank he was at.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of traveling. Every 4 weeks, all through high school, we were on a plane going somewhere. And
that is not inexpensive.
No. Fortunately, my father liked to help with the finances of it because it was his grandson, the next
right.
generation of fencers, right? So we got help, which is good because we had 2 other children we had to feed.
Yeah.
You know? But he was very worried that I, in particular, would be upset. And I couldn't stop laughing when he said that because I never wanted him to fence in the first right. place. I grew up in gyms. I took fencing in college because I thought the coach would be nice to me, but he was harder on me than anybody else because of who my dad was, right? So what I said to him was, look, this was for you. This was never for me. This is not about what has been spent or what has been done. It's about what you're ready to move on to and what you want to do next.
Right.
So he finished the year and he came home and he worked all summer as a roofer to get in really good shape.
That'll do it.
Yep. And then in September, he enlisted in September of 2006. He enlisted and started basic training in Missouri at Fort Leonard Wood, and then went to jump school, and then went to Intel school in Arizona.
Right.
And I got to tell you, you don't want to be at Huachuca, Arizona in July and August. I don't care how dry the heat is. They had him running 5 miles a day, like an Intel analyst really needed to run.
Right.
It's not like he was going to be doing that in the desert and, you know, in the Middle East. So, but he got through all of that, immediately went to Fort Bragg, which is where he wanted to go, and was deployed almost instantly after his training was done because his unit was already over there.
Right.
So his first deployment was significantly shorter than his second one.
His first one. Okay. Right.
And he got married in between, too.
Oh, he did?
He did.
Oh, were you there?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yes, it was a lovely wedding.
Okay. I don't think I knew that part.
Yes, he got married. She was 19 and he was 21. Mm. And he wanted to make sure she had medical benefits when he died because he was sure he was going to go over there and die.
Mm.
And he loved her. And, you know, I'm very happy for him that he got to know the joy of being newly married.
Right.
They were very happy for a while.
Right.
And then they weren't.
Oh, when he got back?
Yeah, because, you know, PTSD is not good for a relationship.
Yeah.
And his brand of PTSD became very challenging. So when he went to the Green to Gold program, he chose UNH because that was where he had joined the Army in New Hampshire, where we lived. And she was from New Hampshire, so she could go and finish her degree, too.
Okay.
And in that last semester, she went away for spring break. And when she came home, he was a heroin addict. Just like that. It's all it takes. I mean, seriously.
Right.
Because he couldn't sleep, and because instead of working with the fencing coach at UNH that he had known his entire life, doing something healthy, somebody said, you know, I have a solution to your sleep problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. And he never graduated because he had to be put into a substance abuse program. My husband and I came up when we found out and took him to his commander and said, help. And the commander sent him to West Point for evaluation, and then he went to a substance abuse program, which meant he couldn't graduate because his time was used up. He had a 4.3 QM. They had like 8 awards lined up for him. It was 3.5 weeks before graduation. So when he went back to Bragg, he was still a sergeant.
Okay.
Which, in and of itself, required some explanation, you know, to his,
right,
the people under him particularly. And he immediately set forth letting them know exactly what had happened, how he'd gotten into the mess that he'd gotten into, and to come to him if they ever had a problem, because he and the guy in charge didn't get along so well. The commander and Daniel didn't like each other, and the mother in me says it's because Daniel was so much smarter than he was.
Right.
You know, who knows? Daniel could also be a real wise ass, and when he, with the combination of smart and wise ass and thinking that the person that's telling you to do something is a moron, can sometimes not work in your favor.
Right, right.
So he was treated very badly by command. And then a year later, he had been clean for the entire year. And the commander came to him and said, look, you're doing too many hours. You stateside, the timing of how much you work is very different from when you're overseas. And the work was what was keeping him out of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it might have been making
it more. Why didn't he care how many hours he was doing? He wasn't paid by the hour.
He wanted to get the work done.
Right. So why do they care?
Oh, they care because It's not good for you mentally to be doing the kind of work that Daniel was doing.
Okay, that makes sense.
And it exhausts you, and then it makes trouble if you're actually really needed desperately for something and you're too tired to do it.
Okay, right? That makes sense.
So they have regulations about that. And he took his leave for Saturday before Easter of 2014.
Still married?
Still married.
Okay.
He had a home and a wife and two cats and what would look like a really good life.
Mm-hmm.
And he took his leave. And 2 o'clock the next morning, we got a call from the Cape Fear Valley Medical Center. He was on life support. He had overdosed. Mm-hmm. He'd used for the first time in a year. And we needed to get there. They thought he was going to die.
Right.
So we drove like crazy people. Only got stopped by the cops once.
Okay.
Which I'm pretty proud of. I'm the driver in the family. And I was like, so there's this big sticker that says Army Mom on the back of my car. And we're going to Cape Fear Valley Medical Center. Does that math add up to you? I said this to the police officer. I was like, in a mood.
Right.
And he said, oh my God, your soldier, is he okay? And I'm like, I don't think so. He said, so I'm not giving you a ticket, but you got to slow down. Because if you don't slow down, then you have other children and family who are going to be, you know, mourning more than just what you're traveling for.
Right.
So we got there. He actually did survive. He pulled through. It was really scary.
Mm.
Nothing like seeing your child hooked up to every machine known to mankind.
Yeah.
It just... But when we knew he was going to be okay, when they were able to take him off of life support, we decided we had to go home. We had jobs and we had the two other kids, and he was going to be all right, and his wife was there. And so we left, and the next day he finally opened up the drawer in the bedside table next to his hospital bed, and there were dishonorable discharge proceedings paperwork in his bedside table because there had been a HIPAA violation committed by a nurse who knew his commander and called and left a message. Keegan is in the hospital on life support, OD'd on heroin and possibly cocaine, not anticipated to survive. Thought you'd want to know.
Wow.
Okay, so I have been a teacher. And I have worked in the medical industry, and I've always been a loudmouth. But
which makes you a great podcaster.
Thank you. But having had...
That's insane.
Yeah. Having had HIPAA pushed down... You always knew... I worked at CareMount for a long time.
Right.
And you always knew that when an email came to the general employee population that said... Remember HIPAA, somebody had just been fired.
Right.
Because they didn't remember HIPAA. And so I didn't know, and Daniel didn't know how they found out. We didn't find out till later. But what happened was
what's behind the policy of a dishonorable discharge for a disease?
Okay, so the policy was if you do not self-report a slip as a participant in the ASAP program, the Army Assistance Abuse Program.
He wasn't able to self-report.
There you go. He was on life support.
Yeah.
When the paperwork
wouldn't type for
me. Exactly. And that's where the problem was. And that I mean, there were lots of problems, but that was the thing. How did you file this when he didn't even have an opportunity to self-report now?
Right.
He was an addict. Whether he would have self-reported or not, I don't know. But he certainly wouldn't have been well enough to return to work in 2 weeks.
Right.
So he would have had to come up with something, and likelihood is that he would have been straightforward about it.
Mm-hmm.
Can't tell.
But you don't know because you didn't have the chance. Didn't have the chance to do it.
So when he left the hospital, they took him back to the base. They took him back to Fort Bragg because now he's a liability for the military. If he gets into trouble in public, they're going to look bad.
Okay.
Couldn't go home to his wife. Couldn't go home to his home. Had to be on base. And Daniel was going to fight this because that's who Daniel was. And he didn't understand how the the commander found out, but that's another story entirely. And 12 weeks into this, his JAG attorney gives him a call and says, "You've got your honorable, and you can stay in the Army if you want to."
Okay. There you go.
I don't know what happened, but I'm leaving. Thank you very much.
Right, yeah.
Right? And the JAG attorney put all of the paperwork, all of his records and all of his paperwork into a manila folder and a manila envelope, sealed it up, handed it to Daniel, and Daniel started the process of trying to get care at the VA. Didn't go so well. It took 13 months for him to get his disability declaration of 90%, even though he had an existing diagnosis upon discharge. It took 13 months, and then 3 months later, he was going to be scheduled to start an inpatient dual diagnosis program through the VA.
Wait, so the Army... This is so fucked up.
It is.
So the Army said... The Army tries to dishonorably discharge him because of a disability... That he didn't report.
Mm-hmm.
Then says, "Well, no. If you wait, if you want money, then no. We were wrong the first time. Is that that's what it was?
Pretty much.
That's crazy.
It's nonsense. And what it turned out happened was Daniel waited. He worked selling affordable care health insurance to anybody who could get his hands on, because he knew so many veterans that were other than honorably discharged,
right,
and would not have access to care for their families. He did so well selling insurance that the company that he was working for gave him a seat in the Charlotte arena. That he could go to whatever he wanted to go to in their box in the Charlotte arena anytime. Okay. So he was very good at that until he completely broke.
The marriage at that point was...
Still together.
Still together. But he couldn't go... Oh, he couldn't go home because they wouldn't let him. Right, they wouldn't let him.
So when he did go home, they were still together for a while. And I kept telling her, look, I know he's an addict. He's unpredictable. You need to look out for your own security more than anything else. This was a well-trained special forces soldier. And, you know, you don't want to be around him when he's angry at you.
Were you afraid of him?
No. No.
Is that because you're a mom? Is that not rational?
You know, there was a doctor at the hospital on another incident who... told me I should be afraid of him. And I listened to him. And after driving 14 hours down to see him in an emergency situation at another time, and first meeting with the doctor and the doctor telling me I needed to leave, I left. And I never forgave myself for it. I got back in the car and I drove 14 hours home. And I never forgave myself for it, because I would have rather dealt with the consequences of his rage than with the consequences of his disappointment.
Yeah, but I understand your decision. I mean, if a doctor tells you,
he didn't like Daniel because Daniel was being a wise ass. He was asking him all sorts of clinical questions that he didn't want to answer. You know, there was Daniel shining bright again. But I don't feel particularly guilty about any of the decisions that I've made over the years, because I worked as hard as I could with the information that I had.
Right.
And there were other things besides Daniel that had to factor into every decision and every choice that was made. I would do it differently.
What would you do different?
I would have stayed that time that I left and went home. I would have stayed. They would have had somebody in there with me. They escorted me to my car. He was screaming. He knew I was there. Mm-hmm. They escorted me to my car. They could have had somebody in there with me.
Mm-hmm.
I would do it differently. I would push back against the doctor's wisdom.
I mean, what would your staying accomplish other than...
I might have been able to talk him into getting help.
Okay. All right.
He needed help. He desperately needed help. They had picked him up because he was high and he was jumping on the hoods of his neighbor's cars. And he was broken. And if I had had that chance to have a conversation with him, I might have been able to help him.
Right.
I might have been able to get him to get help.
Did he have a psychiatric diagnosis?
Yeah.
Oh, he did.
Yeah,
okay.
He had a diagnosis of PTSD, serious depression, and moral injury. Mm. He was suicidal for a long time. And when he realized that if he got through all of this, he might be able to help other people, he stopped the suicidal ideation and started working on what he was going to do when he got well.
That's what it takes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something bigger than you. Yeah.
Something bigger than you. Yeah, that's right. What it takes. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Those shoes I do know. I don't know the army shoes, but
I know. Yeah. I know. And he really wanted help. That's all he ever wanted to do was help.
Right.
So he waited and he waited and he waited and he waited. And he was scheduled to go into the dual diagnosis program on January 21st of 2016. He died on January 8th of 2016. Yep.
So that's the 13 months, right?
That's 16 months.
16 months,
13
sorry.
Months for the designation and then 3 months waiting to for the space in the program.
I can see why you're badass crazy about this.
I'm a little annoyed and extremely annoying.
Well, good. Good. Do you have a relationship with him now?
With?
Dan, y'all.
Like?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I have no doubt in my mind that he and I are talking all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have no doubt. And I'll tell you, the day after he died, we were living in Somers then, and in New York, and it was January 8th, right? So mm-hmm. weather is usually snow or not snow. Mm-hmm. It was pouring rain, and I was sitting at the kitchen table with my two other sons. My middle son was particularly devastated. He and Daniel were especially close. And he asked me, he said, because I had said to them, you know, he's at peace now.
Right.
I know he's at peace now. And after all of the peace that he didn't have for all of those years, if I can find no joy in anything, I can find joy in the fact that I'm certain he is at peace now. And Brian looked at me and like, how do you know? And the rain stopped, and we were sitting in front of a very big kitchen window, and out came the most magnificent double rainbow.
Oh, wow.
You could ever imagine.
Oh, wow.
Everybody I know was taking pictures of this double rainbow. It was spectacular. And Brian looks at me, who's still skeptical, looks at me and goes, okay, I'm not going to ask again. I just knew. So when recently I lost a brother-in-law. And
sorry.
Thank you. And we were on our way home from his funeral and it was raining. And I look out the back window.
Don't.
Yes. Big rainbow. I'm like, yes, yes, rainbow. And I'm like, I told my husband, I says, so Dan's got David.
Yeah.
We're good.
Did I tell you my Shayna Moore story? Do you know that story?
No.
So I had a medium in here who said that her gift is talking to people who have passed.
You recommended her to me. I went and saw her.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. So to talk about her validity. So she could tell I was like, eh. So then I went. She said, come to my house. I'm going to do a reading for you, and then we'll see. And even during the reading, like, I was like, all right, if you have the internet,
right,
a lot of this you can get. And,
right.
You know, and then she would say things like, you know, your dad's very proud of the show and your mom loves the way you play guitar. And like, that's what I would say.
That's what I would say.
At the same time, my daughter, Gramercy, wants to go on a senior trip to the Bahamas unchaperoned with this company called Grad City that's 50% yes reviews, 50% no reviews.
Oh, great.
It's a subject of ongoing discussion. And the way
the way things happen in my house is you get me to say yes first because I'm easy sell, and then you both go tag team Trish until you know she wears down. Because her first answer is no to everything. Like, you could ask her, but she's bad. Like, I would say it's today Thursday, and she'd say no. Even though, just to be.
Just because.
Yeah. So, we were in the process of figuring out whether I was going to say yes to this or not before we went to church. But nobody knew it. Like, even Trish didn't know.
Right.
So, we finish, and she's like, can I take a selfie with you to promote? And I'm like, yeah. So, she pulls out a camera. She goes, Grant? And nobody knew her name. I referred to her as the package until her 70th birthday. So she goes, Graham? And I'm like, Gramercy? And she goes, yeah. She goes, Bahamas. I go, yeah. She goes, don't worry, she'll be fine. And I'm like, okay. Now I believe everything you tell me ever.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. That explains it. That explains why you recommended her so highly.
Yeah.
And I had a very good experience.
Was it amazing?
Yes, it was.
Yeah,
it
and
was.
You and you felt.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I you know, there's this.
That's right. I remember recommending her to you. Yeah. Don't.
There's this line where you look at your skepticism as intellectual.
Yep.
And your positivity as emotional.
Right.
And I'm telling you, in my conversation with her, there was no line anymore.
Wow.
I am not a stupid person. I'm not as smart as Daniel was by any chance. Or
but he
either
came from
of my
somewhere.
Boys. Yeah, my husband.
You might have some DNA in there.
There's some DNA. All right. You know, I taught English for a long time, too, and he got an 800 on the verbal, so I was very happy.
Yeah, yeah.
All three of my boys got an 800 on the verbal.
So they owe you that.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, I like to think so.
That's funny, because I play guitar my whole life, and I can't get my daughter to pick one up.
There you go.
All right, never mind. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's fine. So, for me, I always made my skepticism part of my intellectual personality and my hope as part of my emotional personality. And when this conversation was over, there was no line anymore. Mm. It was just stunning. And I have this thing, my family sometimes doesn't ask me what I think is going to happen because they don't necessarily want to know.
Oh, so you have a little bit of that.
And it's a weird thing.
Do you think we all have that? Yeah, and that it's just to different degrees, but it takes something like traumatic or something to get you to try to exercise that muscle better?
Yes. So when I was young, I had that, and I didn't think there was anything unusual about it, you know, as a kid. And then when I started telling my parents that this was going to happen or that was going to happen, they started looking at me like I was crazy. And then when those things start to happen, they told me that, you know,
you're a witch. Yeah. I mean, obviously.
Just... don't
clearly witchcraft.
Yeah. This is not normal. Just let it go. It's okay to let
it
go.
Oh, so they just blocked it out?
Yeah. And...
Oh, I wouldn't. If my daughter could tell the future, I'd be tagging her every day.
Well, see, that's the thing. My mother was the person who didn't want to know when something was going to happen. Right. She just didn't want to know. And so,
but is it always negative or is it positive too? Like you,
it's almost always negative.
Okay, because I was going to ask questions, but now I'm not.
No, yeah, don't. No, it's almost always negative. And that's where the problem is.
Right.
You know, if I have a feeling that something is not right, it's not going to end up well. And the day that Daniel died, he died on January 8th.
Death by suicide.
No, he died. Daniel had an infection related to his occasional still IV drug use.
Okay.
And he thought he had the flu. And a week before he died, New Year's Eve, Friday of 2015, he called the VA to get a ride over there to get some help for what he thought was the flu. and rides are provided by volunteers, and it was Christmas week, and nobody in their right mind stays in Fayetteville, North Carolina on Christmas week if you can get out of town.
Right.
And Daniel didn't drive anymore, which made the world a much safer place, frankly.
Okay.
But he wouldn't take a cab. He wouldn't go with anyone that he didn't trust, and he only wanted VA help. And he was on hold for 6.5 hours. They tried.
Jesus.
They kept coming back to him and saying, "We're trying, we're trying." And he said, the way he described it to me was, "You know, Mom, the kid on the other end of the line," and I'm thinking, "You're 28.
Yeah, right.
The kid on the other end of the line saying, you know, said to me, "I've tried everything I can to get you a ride. I'm coming to get you. You're 2.5 miles away." And Daniel said, "You can't do that because I only have the flu and you're monitoring a suicide hotline." So he didn't go. And I just didn't have enough information to understand that this was probably not the flu.
Right.
You know, in hindsight, you know a lot.
Of course.
But I didn't have the understanding. And so I called him that night, New Year's Eve, because my boys always race to be the first person that calls me at midnight.
Nice.
Yeah. And I didn't want him to do that. Because I wanted him to sleep. If he could be asleep, I wanted him to be asleep. So I called him at 5 o'clock that afternoon.
If they call at the same time, do you pick which one?
Oh, no, no, no. I just pick up the phone. Whoever's there first is the one that gets it. And now they have taken to house phone and cell phone.
Oh, nice. I think it's cute you have a house phone.
Old. I have no idea what my phone number is.
I'm as old as you are. Oh, okay.
What my home number is. It's just there. Because we just bought a 1969 house, and there was a phone attached to the wall.
The
money that it would have cost to get rid of the phone, it was attached to the wall, and patch it was not worth the trouble.
Understood.
But I called him and I said, "Look, consider yourself the winner this year. You've got like just 22 days to go, and you will get the care, and you have done everything you could to stay alive in the most grueling set of circumstances." And he said to me, "I will make you proud of me again." And I said, "You cannot understand, and you never will until you're a parent, that your mere effort to survive so that you could help other people survive is more heroic and makes me more proud than anything I could have ever imagined. You can't."
Right.
But it wouldn't register with him.
Yeah.
So, you know.
You're in that place. It's hard to hear.
Exactly.
Why is VA so fucked up?
Okay. So there's a couple of things. Part of the problem is that it's very hard to hire enough people on the budget that they have to do the work that needs to be done. So you're looking at Fayetteville, North Carolina, where my son was. There's Fort Bragg and Pope Air Force Base there.
Okay.
Bragg, which was Liberty for a minute and is back to being Bragg again, and Pope Air Force Base. And there's, at any given time, at least 75,000 to 125,000 members of the military in that town. Most of them have families. Most of them have homes. They're going to stay, if they can, in the community that their children are getting educated in. You know, the town that their wives or husbands have jobs in after they leave the military. So you now have
all of
the active duty and all of the veteran population and all of their families. And they have the same number of providers in Fayetteville, North Carolina, as they do in Muncie, New York.
Why is VA taking care of active members?
You know, there are times when if you have an active duty military-related injury, which happens all the time on base, you get your care from the VA.
But why? That seems to me to be one thing that could be separated to reduce the load.
It could. The problem for a lot of service members is that they appreciate being seen by people who have more experience with their circumstances than with private practitioners.
Right.
So that's
where are you on universal health care then?
I love the idea of universal health care. I am adamant that in addition, we have to be able to provide to service members who choose the VA, we have to be able to provide those services. Mm-hmm. Those promises were made. And for somebody like Daniel, who, because of his level of secrecy, because he wasn't able to disclose so much of what he went through, would never ever have gone to a private practitioner because he had clearance. And to the day we lost him, that clearance was key for him. He had this clearance. He wanted to be able to discuss the circumstances that got him to where he was with people who were guaranteed to not divulge anything they heard. And if a private practitioner feels a level of concern for the safety of anyone or the people around them, they will disclose,
right?
Where the VA will likely handle that differently.
Right.
The VA is critical. I think we need universal health care. Having worked in the healthcare industry, I cannot tell you how much nonsense I have seen that should never have happened. Because corporations are running medicine now.
Right.
And that's not okay. It's not okay.
Yeah. So primarily it's finance. Are VA doctors, Steph, what's the pay equity compared to private sector?
Oh, you won't get paid. You'll be lucky if you get paid half in VA what you could
start
with.
So you got to be doing it for love anyway.
Yes. Yes. You have your reasons for doing that. And occasionally there's the doctor who doesn't feel like they're qualified to do it anywhere else, so they go there and they get their start and then they leave.
Right. Is that an argument for privatizing it then, if to attract better people with better salaries?
No.
Because
there are so many people like Daniel who will not get care at all if the only care they can get is privatized treatment.
Right.
They won't do it. It's hard enough to get some of these folks to go in and be seen and get taken care of for anything, right, from a simple hangnail to a suicidal ideation. To get them to go to anyone is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The starting point is you'll be with people who understand how you got here.
Right.
And you cannot guarantee that in privatized practice. You just can't.
Right. So back to Trump then.
Yes.
I was like really scared in the beginning, and I wasn't necessarily a Biden fan either. But I,
right.
But I kind of feel like, especially over the last like 2 weeks, everything always gets rolled back with this guy.
Right.
So, you know, you create this mountain of fear of, I'm going to hack, and then you can just kind of predict, okay,
right,
90 days from now, you will flip this.
Exactly.
And my only fear is he's potentially not going to run for office again.
Right.
So he's not worried about a constituency.
Right.
So now you got to rely on moral character. That might be a challenge.
Yeah, that is definitely a challenge.
Yeah.
He's so unpredictable, and sometimes I think he's unpredictable because that keeps people on their toes, and sometimes I think he's unpredictable because he's insane.
Well, what's the value of keeping people on their toes, though?
Well, you're not paying attention to the one thing in the corner that he might be doing that he's not talking about.
Oh, okay. All right.
So if he's got this, like, evil genius plan somewhere in the back of his head and he doesn't want you to know about it, he's going to make you crazy with these 47 other things that he's doing.
Right.
Honestly, the likelihood of an evil genius plan or an evil positive person plan is slim, to be kind. He doesn't like me anyway, so I don't suppose it really matters. You know, I was not allowed in his in the White House during his first term.
Is that true?
Yes, that's true.
You specifically are not allowed in the White House.
Me specifically.
So, how do they tell you that?
I got invited to a veterans roundtable by somebody who had just moved into the White House staff because he was John McCain's veteran staffer.
Okay.
And McCain was ill. Not gone yet, but ill. And it was clear he wasn't coming back. So this wonderful young veteran who looked in my concerned mother's face, just like Daniel, who was clearly pushing hard to fix things that he felt like he participated in. He invited me to this veterans roundtable.
Very cool.
And
very cool.
Yeah, extremely cool. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I got a call from him a few days later, and he said, I have been told that I can have this veterans forum roundtable in the White House without you, or I can do it in Starbucks with you.
Ooh. Ooh. Well, you must be doing something right.
Well, that's it. You know, the first time he ran, he said something about weak versus strong veterans. I got a little cranky. I didn't like that. When I came back from lunch, having just spoken to, you know, somebody who was a friend of Daniel's who was very close to him when he died, I get back to my desk, and there on my MSN screensaver is Trump says. And so I shot a response. I didn't know who I was responding to. I just shot off a response. I said, you know, not for nothing, because I am an educator at heart. When you have the biggest podium in the world, but you don't know all the facts, perhaps you should just say thank you and let the people who do know the facts take care of the issues. Mm-hmm. Not intending to be as disrespectful as he thought I was, but gloriously being disrespectful now. Mm-hmm. I have to say, you know, he didn't like that. And so the next day, Daniel was on the whole front page was Daniel's picture. A little teeny picture of Donald Trump in the corner in his military school uniform and Kim Kardashian, who had just been robbed the day before in Paris.
Mm.
So this is October of 2016.
Mm.
And you're a candidate for president. And I'm sure your intent is good, right? So use your good intent to get the experts to speak about this. I mean, I knew who Donald Trump was. I grew up in New York. This was not news to me. But I wanted to give him the opportunity. Dan was the front page of the Daily News, and the entire middle spread of the Daily News was the piece that I wrote and photographs, right? Yeah. He didn't like me. Didn't like me.
Ever tell you my Trump story?
No.
It's a great story. You remember the Learning Annex in the city?
Yeah.
So he did a Learning Annex, and mm-hmm. I was friends with Al of Doral. Doral is Dorothy and Al.
Okay.
I was friends with the Al, and he was friends with Trump.
Right.
So he said, hey, come to this thing, and afterwards we'll go to dinner. There'll be like 10 people, and we'll go to dinner. So he wasn't running for anything back then, but so I go. And we're sitting at a table, and he tells this story. I'll never forget this. He goes, he'd been through, I forget when it was, but he had just been through like another, a big bankruptcy.
Yep.
Maybe the casino, maybe. So he's telling the story, and he goes, yeah, so the other day, I'm sitting in my office, and the secretary calls in and says, you know, the vice president of Bank of America is here to see you. And he's like, okay, let him in. So he comes in, and he goes, Mr. Trump, you have a problem. And Trump says, what's my problem? And he says, your problem is that you owe Bank of America $700 million.
Mm.
And Trump goes, if I owe Bank of America $700 million, you have a problem.
God.
Yeah, yeah. I
oh.
I will never forget that. It was amazing.
God, he is. Yeah.
All right, tell me about the book. How hard are you working on it?
Okay, so when I retired last April, I thought I would start working on it right away. That didn't happen. There were.
How do you like retirement?
I'm really busy, but good. I am doing the work I want to do. I'm working with Senator Blumenthal in Connecticut now. I got to tell you about that when I'm done with this little piece. I am starting now. Now that we are settled in our new home, which is a bit of an adventure in and of itself, and I'm laying out time specifically to work on this. I'm interviewing people. I want positive experiences, negative experiences, any kind of experience with the VA as a patient, an employee, or a combination thereof. I want to know, because in order to figure out a way to create effective change, you have to know where the people who are experiencing the problems are getting caught in glitches, right? Or what's going particularly well, because frankly, to have a discussion with any federal organization about anything that's not going well, you have to be able to come in with some positive attributes, right? You have to. So this is going to be, I have become sort of friends with Jake Tapper. I discussed this with him. I would like to write a book about the VA, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and find the places that can be improved effectively and as efficiently as possible.
You know about corporate turnaround?
Yeah, a little.
All right, so I did that for a long time.
Okay.
I don't understand why that is not the first reach for somebody like trying to do what you're doing, or trying to do what Musk was trying to do, or it, because that's the mission. Corporate turnaround, you go in, you have a finite set of resources, and your specific skill set is with this finite set of resources. How can I flip this over to be productive? Why don't you people talk to these people?
You know, it's very, very hard to get somebody who's not veteran experience and is outside of the federal government to want to have a conversation about how they can help the federal government
hire
do something
them.
Right. Well, yeah, just costs money.
Yeah. Well, look, you're retired now.
Well, depending on how the book goes.
Right.
But seriously, I had a bill that Elizabeth Warren wrote for me that went into the 2019 NDAA. Our conversation started, I don't remember the day, early January of 2019. NDAA is submitted at the end of March, I think, in 2019. In the last 3 weeks before the NDAA was submitted, that bill that I wanted, that I actually helped to design and create, that came from Daniel's experience, that bill was part of the 2019 NDAA. It took a couple of people who really cared and were involved. And that bill, the heart of that bill, it's called the Warm Handoff, was because as a mother of
three... That was my nickname in college.
Oh, God.
Sorry, I was sitting right there.
No.
low-hanging fruit. It was there, right there.
Oh, there
I apologize.
You go. No, that's fine. So because I had raised three boys, my husband and I, on a tight budget with a lot of expenses, I learned very quickly how to be efficient and frugal. And I knew that the only way that a federal organization was going to agree to any change was if it was efficient and frugal. So this bill says, on the day of discharge, and I narrowed it down to the smallest group I could get, on the day of discharge, anybody who's leaving with an already existing diagnosis is escorted to their nearest VA location to start the process of evaluation and treatment plans, so that piece is taken care of, because that was 90% of Daniel's problem, was just getting in the door.
Right.
So you work with the things that you know you have that don't cost anything. And this is why it's so important that we focus on doing things in a way that is positively impactful and can show people that you can do it for next to nothing.
If I give you a corporate turnaround executive, will you interview them?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Right. I would be delighted.
Okay, I will make that happen.
Absolutely.
I will make that happen. Oh, well, because this, because what you're attempting to do is that's the job. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and mm-hmm. it, you know, you say it's hard to find somebody veteran specific, but a corporate turnaround professional, the point is to not be specific.
But, right.
So they may be great
insight.
It's
a connection there. That helps, though, because it's hard.
Right.
It's hard to make those connections if you're not in those circles.
Those connections also kind of narrow the thinking,
right?
Because you already have predisposed notion of what's possible, what's right. not possible, how long this is going to fucking take. Right. This is never going to fly. You think in small bites because that's all there ever was,
right?
And so I will get you somebody.
Thank you.
Are you a disciplined writer, or are you just kind of a when I have the?
It's kind of a mix. I set times that I have to sit and
work. Okay. Oh, so you are disciplined.
Yes, but I also get up in the middle of the night and start playing with words.
The question everybody wants to know the answer to. Has your husband ever won an argument with you?
No.
That's what I thought. Okay.
No. We're
you ever throw him a bone and just like...
Oh, all the time. We are actually a spectacularly fortunate pair. We've been married almost 41 years now.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's still my favorite person in the whole world.
What is the secret of 41 years?
Silence.
It sounds a little bit like avoiding conflict.
Well, you take a deep breath, you wait a moment, and you see if it really matters. Like, yeah. For example, my youngest son, who is 33 years old, God bless him, my youngest son used to get really annoyed by the fact that my husband never closes a cabinet door, ever.
Guilty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Guilty.
Not an uncommon phenomenon.
Okay. Phew.
Never closes a cabinet door. And he finally came to me one day and he said, I don't understand. How is this acceptable? If I left it open, and that's where I stopped him. And I said, if you left it open, I would be just as quiet as I am with your father. The difference is I might get a little crankier with you later on because I don't have to live with you all the time.
Right, right.
And someday I am likely to be living my life without him.
Mm.
And I will miss those open doors more than I can even begin to imagine.
Yeah.
So I'll close a goddamn cabinet door. It's bothering me. It's not bothering anybody else.
Well, that's the wisdom you get there. Like, you hit a specific benchmark and you can see that, you can see the goal line.
Right.
And the perspective that gives you. I think that's the whole foundation of why wisdom comes with age, is because you see an end line.
Exactly.
And that tailors everything.
Exactly. And my perspective is different than most people's because most people haven't lost a child.
Right.
So there's also that piece that says, you don't know. You have no idea what tomorrow's going to bring. Do I want my last conversation to be about cabinet doors?
Right.
No, yeah. I don't. Like, my last conversation with my child, I will never be able to express how incredibly grateful I am that our last words were love. I love you so much. And he was like, I love you so much. And we'll get through this. And you're doing so well. And I love you. And there will never be a moment where I am not grateful for that.
That's beautiful.
That last conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and it tints everything that I do moving forward.
Sure.
I mean, I adore my husband. I have always adored my husband. I am a very, very lucky woman. But he's the same with me that I am with him, in that you don't say
things you don't have to. He thinks he never lost an argument.
Yeah. There's that. But he also...
You have done your job well, lady.
I try. I'm patient. But he also doesn't say things that don't need to be said.
Yeah.
And that gives you the opportunity to be heard when you say something that needs to be said.
Yeah. It's so Trish had that head and neck cancer thing. So she gets out of that. We clear the fence. It's all good. I'm coming to do a show, and she calls me, and she's like, I'm in the hospital. And of course, I'm like, what? No. And she's like, I broke my ankle in a spin class. And I go, oh, my God, how is it? She goes, it's adorable. And that's the perspective that you get. Exactly. Right, right, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's it. And, you know, there are so many people who, with the greatest kind intent, tell me they can't imagine that they would be able to survive what I've survived. Tell me how sorry they are. There are the people who, when they hear my arguments against the current administration, thank me and then say, but.
Right.
You know? But the fact is that until you've had these experiences, until you know how bad it can get, you don't know how lucky you are in the simplest of things.
Yeah.
And I am so lucky. Mm. I have this incredible husband, two really wonderful human being children who sometimes drive me a little crazy.
Yeah. That's part of it.
Yeah, that is part of it.
That's the job description.
And fortunately, none of them was like and either of the other ones, so that they all had a different brand of drive mom crazy, which meant that I was always crazy, but at least I wasn't, you know, I wasn't fighting the same fight over and over.
Right, because that gets boring.
Yeah, it does. It gets boring. But I'm really lucky, and as crappy as what I've been dealt has been, I'm really lucky, and I have this big fat mouth, and I use it, and I wasn't in Connecticut for, I don't know, a month before I was contacting local electeds there.
Tell me the senator.
Okay, Senator Blumenthal. Senator Blumenthal is a veteran and has children who are veterans. That in and of itself is kind of remarkable in our electeds these days.
He's not a hedge fund manager.
No.
Oh, that's nice.
No, okay. No. And he was the Attorney General of Connecticut for years. I actually had met him when I was working in the governor's office before Dan was born. But he didn't remember me. Anyway, the senator has written a piece of legislation, and they asked me, I met with his staff, and they figured I probably wasn't going to make too much of a mess of things, so they asked me to speak when he was introducing this bill. It is called Protecting Our Veterans. The fact that you have to write a piece of legislation that specifically states that we will keep our promises is mind-numbing to me. But this legislation is brilliant and goes so far beyond we're going to keep our promises. We're going to protect these people. You know, as soon as he heard about the pending layoffs at the VA, he went full steam ahead. And this piece of legislation, if I could say nothing else, it's in committee now. If I could say nothing else to anybody who's listening to this, pick up your phone and call your elected and tell them to support this bill. It is brilliant and essential, and it's criminal that it has to be written in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, you made promises so that you could get people in danger, and then you don't keep your promises, and now you want to even diminish the work you're doing to keep your promises. It's unacceptable, and this is brilliant. So I'm working with him. I met Murphy's staff. I've spoken a couple of times in
Hartford.
That's
cool, though. You're going to use AI to write the book?
No, God, no.
A little bit?
No.
Not at all?
Not at all.
Oh, that's a big chore.
I am an old school English teacher.
That's right. You're okay.
I can't.
Have you ever played with it?
A little bit.
It's scary.
It is. It's terrifying.
It's scary.
It's terrifying. And I specifically want to be able to say there is no AI involved in this process at all. Are
you going to do the audiobook yourself?
I don't know.
You have to.
Well, probably.
You have a great voice. You have to. You have
to. You think
to.
So, really?
Yeah, very,
well,
yeah.
That's so sweet. Thank you.
No, you have to.
I probably will. First, we have to get it published, and that's where my friend Jake might be of some help.
Do you have a schedule?
No, not yet.
Okay. Yeah, that's how...
That's my fault because I've delayed the real start.
Of... All you got to do is use AI for the schedule. Just go and... Look, you can't help me write the book, but give me realistic deadlines.
Okay, yes, and that's exactly what I'm working on right now.
Okay, look, I can solve it. Do it right now. We can get this through the schedule as we sit here.
I want people who have no experience with the VA system to understand that there's an absolute need for it, and these are the issues and the values of it, so that good work can get done.
I kind of look at it like if my daughter was on a railroad track and there was a train coming, mm-hmm. and some guy I didn't know came and grabbed her, risked his own life, and hauled her off the track. And my response was to not get to know that guy.
Yeah.
That's an amazing societal response to veterans. Mm-hmm. You just literally hauled my daughter off a railroad track.
Exactly.
And my response is to just not get to know you.
Right.
How do you...
You know, there is...
Are we that fat?
Yes.
That's the answer, yes. Right? We're just that fat.
Yes. And then you have, at this point, an administration that really doesn't care. They can tell you they care. And I get so many people who say, well, you must have voted for Trump because he is the veteran president, you know, the president for veterans. Like, are you kidding? I'm not allowed in the White House.
Yeah.
Because I said something veteran related that he didn't like. This is not about doing what's right. It's about doing what he wants to do.
You know what amazes me, though? And I'm not a Republican, but it amazes me. Like, on the national level, sure. But on the local level... Like, the politicians I meet who are, like, the most effective and genuine seem to be Republican. Does that make you insane?
No, actually, I like effectiveness no matter what side of the aisle it comes from. I have a particular level of experience with one particular local Republican elected that is less than positive, to say the least.
Okay.
And, you know, I... don't want to get myself in trouble, but this particular guy, and he'll know if he listens to this, if anybody who works with him listens to this,
he will know who he is.
Because he went after me.
Yeah.
On social media, he went after me while I was standing at a microphone talking about my dead veteran son.
You know, I talked to his aide about that.
Oh, did you?
Yep. Yeah, a bunch, because I try to offer equal time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, look, you know, here's the story. Come on. And this was like a couple, this, you did the show like a couple years ago. So mm-hmm. like, I'm going to be hazy on the details.
Yeah.
Wouldn't come on.
Right.
And the argument was, it's not a fight you can win.
Right.
And it's like, her son is a vet who died. You can't have that fight. And I'm like, well, how about not trying to win a fight?
Right.
How about just have a discussion and figure it out?
Let's have a conversation.
Yeah.
The only reason I was there holding that microphone is because his staff refused to have a conversation with me.
Right.
I just wanted some questions answered about why he believed everything was going to be so hunky-dory and fine and dandy. Just give me the facts, because if there are facts to back that up, I will be right there next to you.
Well, that's touting them. That's a problem. With this environment is not. I'm so tired of hearing that we're polarized.
Yeah,
but the problem is nobody's willing to give you the facts in an environment where you could accept them, so that you could change your mind.
Right.
It never gets to that stage of the conversation.
Right.
And so it's not brain science. Nobody's changing their mind.
Right.
Nobody's sitting down going, "Hey, this is safe. I'm Republican. You're a Democrat. I don't think you're an asshole.
Right.
I think you're funny. I think you're smart. I disagree with you on a couple things.
Yeah.
Here's the facts of why I think the way I think."
Exactly.
And then maybe the dial moves for somebody, but nobody does that.
Nobody does that. It's very frustrating. And this is a guy who supposedly had some words with Trump about the beautiful big bill nonsense because of SALT. And the salt taxes, and how he's not going to come out looking really good if they cut the salt taxes. And then he went and voted for the damn thing anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, tell me, you're seriously pushing back? No, I don't think so. When somebody asks you a question at an event, a public forum, you have them hauled out by the state police because you don't like what they're saying. Mm. This is
was
not
that scary? Answering.
I wasn't there for that one.
Okay.
I was not there for that one. But
when
I
people
know
get
the
hauled
person-
out. When, even watching, when people get hauled out for saying something,
boy,
that's if that's not the edge, it's 1 foot away from the
right.
edge.
And why are we using state police to do it?
Right.
They picked up this social worker, wonderful woman, remarkably kind person who just wanted an answer to a question. And she barked back at him when he didn't answer the question. And they picked her up and carried her out of the building. State police, the same people who would be at her car wreck if she got killed on her way right. home. They picked her up and carried her out of the building. Why is an elected official allowed to hire state police to haul somebody out of an event? You've got your own security. Use it.
Yeah. What do you do for fun?
Oh, I do a lot of things for fun, actually. We just came back from Charleston, South Carolina. I'm a history buff, and it was delightful. I knit and I crochet.
Oh, do you?
I have done.
Are you part of a group called Knitwits? Yes, or no, everybody who knits part of a group called Knitwits?
No.
Good. All right. No. I respect you.
I'm fairly good at it, and it keeps me from killing people unless they get helpful. Me angry while I have a needle in my hand.
It's crime prevention.
Right. Oh, trust me, because
it's a hobby that saves lives.
Yeah, exactly. And it helps me to sleep because at the end of the day, after doing this kind of thing all day long, it's very hard for me to turn it off enough to fall asleep.
Right.
I don't sleep very well. And so knitting separates the frustration from
it's meditative,
It is. It's very
yeah.
Unless you're doing something you can't figure out and then you become homicidal again and your husband goes, "Put the knitting down."
It's a flip of a switch between you and homicidal.
Yes.
Not a long fuse there.
Right. Yes. I get cranky.
That's all right. grandkids? You have grandkids?
No.
Is there a plan for grandkids?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Don't ask?
If I had grandchildren, I'd be more involved in their lives than I'm prepared to be right now because my children are struggling.
Oh, okay.
And Daniel never had children. His wife left him the day he got his disability declaration. She was already engaged to somebody else.
Oh, shit. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
In the Air Force, because she was a uniform girl.
Man, that'll push it to a bad decision.
Well, he didn't. He knew she left, but he didn't know she was engaged. He never knew that.
Wow.
When my husband went down with my brother-in-law to help clear out some of the stuff from Daniel's place, she met with them for dinner, and she took her engagement ring off. And I said, just ask her. I'd be willing to bet there's somebody else because she doesn't do alone well. And she said, oh, no. I mean, I'm dating somebody.
Mm.
And because Daniel died in January, she was able to move her wedding up by 8 months because she didn't have to wait for the divorce.
You know my divorce rant, right? You know my marriage rant?
Yeah.
Yeah. Every time I hear a story like that, it makes me fucking crazy.
You know, they were very, very young when they got married and of very different upbringings. She is brilliant. She really is very, very bright. She knows how to use her brilliant and she knows how to use her pretty very well. She's also super religious. Went to Liberty University.
She's not that religious if she's engaged to somebody else.
Thank you very much.
I'm not a Bible scholar, but...
She was mad at me for not letting her go to the funeral or not inviting her to the funeral. And this is what I did. So I never wanted Daniel to know that we had concerns about that relationship because he loved her.
Right.
And she made him happy. And he was going to war. And
there's enough already.
When It fell apart because I knew it would fall apart. I didn't know how or why, but I knew it would fall apart. I wanted him to be comfortable coming back to us and talking to us.
And not hearing I told you so.
Right. Not that I have ever used that expression, but, he would be thinking it in his head. Right. So nobody knew. She didn't know. We treated her like family. I was incredibly kind to her. When he died, I had called her every day for a week between the last time I called him, spoke to him and the day we found out that he had died. I'd called her every day asking her if she knew anything because I knew she was still in town. And she said, oh, no, there's nothing. He's fine. I'm sure you're just worrying too much. Relax. And then I had to call her to ask her to unlock the door because even though she wasn't still living there, they went to do a welfare check. We called the police. They went to do a welfare check, and they couldn't see anything, so they couldn't break the door down. There was nothing to see. I had to call her, and she had to take her lunch break to wait for the police to come back so she could open the door. And that's when she told me that she knew he had made a pie on New Year's Eve.
Mm.
So a whole week went by, and, I was a little cranky about that. He died 4 hours before they found him. And, you talk about that sense that something is happening. We had decided that Friday, we went from Friday to Friday, and that Friday my husband was going to call the police because I had done it once before and I didn't want to be that mom,
Right.
So my husband called them, and I was getting ready for work, and it was 6:02 in the morning, and I went from, terrified to completely serene at 6:04 in the morning. And they found him at 10:15. Right? So he had held on as long as he could, but he was so sick at that point that if we hadn't gotten to him early in the week, he would probably not have made it anyway.
Right.
But, it's a very long, complicated situation.
Are you religious?
A little bit. Yeah.
Were you raised Catholic?
No, I was actually, I was adopted and, as Irish Catholic as I look,
You do have that.
Yeah. I was raised by a family of Russian Ukrainian heritage, and we were Jewish.
Hilarious.
Right?
That's hilarious.
And my brother, who was my parents' natural child, and I look enough alike so that, that never became a question.
Yeah,
that I was adopted until I was 15, and I found out because I had a twin sister who was adopted into a different family.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How'd you find out the twin sister?
She went to camp with a girl who went to school with me.
You were Ancestry DNA before Ancestry DNA.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
I have not had a boring life. Had a boring life.
Did you, are you in contact with her?
She passed away a few years ago. We had my mom in June, Daniel the following January, my mother-in-law the same year on Veterans Day of all things, and then my sister the following May.
Run.
A lot. But we were in touch. It's kind of creepy how similar we were.
Foster kid, then got adopted. So ignored it for 60 years successfully. My wife gives me this Ancestry DNA kit for Christmas because she says, Gramercy deserves to know, lineage.
Absolutely.
Ethnicity and medical.
And medical history.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay. Spit in a vial. Send it down. Get it back. I see this connection with this one woman who looks a lot like me. And so I write her, and I'm like, hey, I think I'm your brother. She's marvelous. Her name is Debbie. It's great. She goes, okay, but there's some news. And I'm like, what? Apparently, my dad populated the East Coast single-handedly.
Oh, God.
There's actually a Facebook group of us in the 30s.
God.
Trying to figure, 30 members high, trying to figure out, are we, which will make you really conscientious about reviewing your dating history?
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
You're like, absolutely. I am positive, but I'm really lucky. Like, I've met like sisters and brothers, cool. and they all seem very nice, except for one guy.
Yeah.
But they all seem.
There's got to be one in everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a sister like lives like 10 minutes from here who comes to everything I do.
That's
really nice.
So
yeah,
cool.
But my father's, this is my, you talk about, you get to our age, you think legacy, right?
Yeah.
This is my father's legacy. He's 17, he joins the Navy. He's 17, he gets discharged from the Navy. So do that math. He and his, he then becomes a national media sensation for this trick.
Okay.
He gets two friends. He's 17. He goes to work in a Turkish bathhouse. And he says, hey, when they're all in the bath, we're going to raid all the lockers. We're going to fake that you kidnapped me. We're going to drive from Manhattan up to Newburgh in the middle of the winter. And I'm going to walk in the police station and say that you kidnapped me. What he didn't factor in was that the police saw them drive up.
Oh, my God.
And he goes, I was kidnapped by these by these two guys. And the police are like, and they dropped you off at the police station? They didn't get out of the parking lot before they're all busted. Two hours later, they're all, you know, they're all ratting on each other.
Yeah, of course they are.
And there's a picture of my dad in a sleeveless T-shirt in January, handcuffed to a radiator in the Newburgh police station.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and it got picked up all over the place. So that's my
of course.
Yeah, that's my. Of course it did. I fight that gene every day.
You know, if we all knew everything we thought we wanted to know about our history, we'd all be very uncomfortable.
Yeah, you're right. And there's some of that ancestry DNA thing is weird because some of it is so right. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you like dogs better than people, probably. You know, better at team sports, probably. But then it says you're least likely to be musical. And
okay.
And I'm like, no. They must be talking about my wife who doesn't like my music. Maybe
right,
that's
there
what
you go. There
maybe
you go. Oh,
about.
My God. That's
you funny. Happy otherwise?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You know, we have retired to be near family. We spend time with them. We've got this beautiful museum piece of a 1969 home. It's 1969
That's
in
cool.
this house. It was just wild. We're D1969ing it a bit, but that's because I already lived in 1969.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
I don't need to live 1969 again.
Right.
But it is the piece of property and the home that I have always wanted. And I figure after 45
wonderful.
Years of working, how lucky am I
that
I
like
get
that.
To live where I've always wanted to live.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. I live in a community that has a significant amount of people who are financially struggling in a lovely, lovely neighborhood that is just not to be believed, right next door to the community that is one of the wealthiest in the state of Connecticut.
Mm.
So I was driving from the post office to the grocery store yesterday, and I was driving my husband's car because my husband had my car because he was cleaning out his recently deceased brother's place in Massachusetts, and my car's bigger. And I'm complaining to myself about how I hate this car and it's so stupid and it doesn't do what I want it to do. And I watch a couple of people walking out from the grocery store down the street with carts with their groceries in it, probably because they can't afford a car.
Right.
And I am complaining about a car
kind
that
makes
I don't
you feel
like.
Silly, right? Yeah.
I'm thinking, okay, so remember, lucky. Really,
right.
really.
Remember that your broken ankle is adorable.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's what you got to remember.
That's it.
Yeah. What's next for me? We have to wait a while for the book.
Yeah.
And doing anything in between?
Oh, yes. So I may be testifying in front of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs.
Not in the White House, you're not.
No, not.
Okay.
The problem is that it's very hard for one side of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs to get the other side on the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs to answer a phone call.
Mm.
Now, that's where we have dropped to.
Yeah.
If you were in one party and you call the other members of your committee in the other party, They're not going to answer the phone.
Yes.
Like,
I don't know what all is lost looks like, but I could see it looking like that.
It's crazy.
If you can't pick up the phone, we're...
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
You're on the same damn committee, and you're there for a reason.
Right.
Do your damn job. You know, and so I'm not exactly sure what the testimony will look like, whether it will be a full committee or what they call a shadow committee,
right,
which has to be called by the minority. If you're the minority leader and you call a committee meeting, the other people don't have to come.
Right. That's a great rule.
Isn't that nice?
That's a great rule.
So there's that. And I'm just going to enjoy the ability to be obnoxious and annoying as long as I possibly can. Because I've worked for 45 years. It is time for me to be able to do unhindered the kind of work that I had to stop doing because I couldn't afford to do it
right
anymore. I'm retired now, and I may not be able to do it in the same, you know, financial format as I did it before, but I will do it, and I love nothing more than doing it. So, you know, I'm working with a group of veterans, and 5051, do you know what 5051 is? An organization like Indivisible. They do work that helps communities who are fighting against the administration primarily at this point. And they're very, you should look them up.
Okay.
They're a very large and growing organization. And between them and Indivisible in the area of Connecticut that we're in, this group of really sweet Vietnam veterans, I've been able to do one, I participate in one event with them that went pretty well, and we're doing another one on June the 6th because it is very important that as we celebrate the victories that our military has accomplished, we remember the losses that went along with that. And then, of course, on the 14th of June, I'm doing another one because I'm not celebrating a parade for that man. He is not taking people's children in uniform and making them march in front of him to feel proud without a whole lot of other people saying, no, this is not okay. You know, and I'm pretty sure there will be more legislation to work on.
What did I forget to ask you?
I can't think of anything.
There we go.
Here we go.
We're good?
We're good.
Thank you for coming in and doing this.
Of course.
Thank you for making that hump, too. That's a long drive.
You know what? It's for me, it's not a big deal.
Okay.
It's really... I would have told you if it was a big deal. It's
all right.
Not a big deal.
Because we can do virtual anytime you want, too. So
I like seeing
it's
you.
Better. It's better. It's always better in here, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You look fantastic, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You look really good.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Retirement agrees with
it
me.
It does.
I hated my job so much. I cannot tell you how much I hated my job.
hold on, let me mark where that is. Alright, we're saying bye. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
You did good. Okay. Thank you. Alright, bye.